want to thank you all for coming. It's been really amazing to see some people I haven't seen for years. And it's going to be a great chance to discuss a lot of the issues that we've been waiting to talk to each other about on the panel for several months now. I'm always a little suspect and uneasy around the act of speculating on my own work. But in the last few months, I've had a chance to reflect on it and do a bit of writing around it. So I'd like to bookend the talk today, begin it and end it with a little short piece of writing at each end. The work demands that I negotiate my presence before it, around it, under it, through it. The site looms above and veers past, willing me to compromise, to give ground. Overbearing and precarious, its appetites mirror my own. I roll and pinch the thing into place. I collect and lay offerings at its feet. This architecture melts and leans. It hoards objects in its folds. It lurches and dares you to approach. It tears cloth and flesh. It collapses with a brush of a hand. Structurally, my work embodies questions around risk and survival, themes that continue to surface for me as a humanitarian aid worker in the 90s in Laos and Thailand, and as a literature major reading Margaret Atwood and other Canadian authors that were really absorbed with themes of survival and risk. What is at risk? Who is at risk? What might I risk? I'm curious about the fractured and wet spaces of ceramics. In my studio and teaching practice, I investigate fragility and precariousness, vulnerability and aggression. I'll be showing two of my most recent works. The first one I'll show is from last year. It's a solo exhibition I did at the Alberta College of Art and Design in Calgary, Alberta. I worked with students there, and they worked as my assistants to work in this kind of wet and fractured space of ceramics. So we built work in the kiln, and together we took pieces that I had built, hand-built, and pinched together in these grid structures and shipped them from wherever I was able to build them. I move around a lot, so some of these were shipped from parts of Thailand, souvenir kitsch objects, cows and elephants, swans and deer. And I built a lot of it in my studio in Vancouver, so kind of importing ceramics from there. And then I had a studio session in Ontario. So these things came from around North America and Asia as well. The name of the exhibition was Che'et Sia, a collage of different Asian languages. Che'et is to giggle in the Karen language, and Sia is to lose in Thai. So as a child growing up in Asia and in Canada, these mixes of languages that I learned kind of were a pastiche of meaning that came together for me. And the ceramics comes together in a very similar way. Things taken from kind of an abstract expressionist, kind of visceral kind of building, others very small and pinched and embroidered in a much more sedentary space, and others just given to me as gifts by people who have broken their coffee cup. I come to my office in the morning and sometimes there'll be broken ceramics out there. And when I go to a place, I go to sites that seem important to the people who are working with me and to the gallery space itself. So in this case, I went to the sculpture graveyard of the Alberta College of Art and Design, where students had thrown away metal sculptures, old ceramic waste, and I brought these back into the space to work with the students to build these works that, for me, are finding that point of tension between construction and collapse. Two weeks ago, I installed my most recent work at the Mackenzie Art Gallery near the University of Regina in Saskatchewan. The Mackenzie Art Gallery is a public art gallery with many years of fundraising. And in their depths, they have this basement area called Deep Six. And they store all of their fundraising props and old lions. There's a gold plaster lion by an artist from the area called Joe Fafard, and these cardboard pillars that were part of a Romanesque kind of a prop situation that they had, a theatrical space that they had. So I brought all these up, and I created a place where people could interact with me. This is the first time I tried actually collaborating, not just working with assistants, but collaborating with people from the community. So I went to architectural restoration and salvage sites and found objects that seemed to resonate with what was happening in the gallery while other artists were installing. There was a lot of work around the blue willow design, a ceramic plate design that includes a bridge, often two lovebirds, and three entities walking over the bridge. And not so consciously, but I went out there and I found this bridge structure that was, right now it's upturned, but at the beginning it was just a bridge you can walk over. And the Canadian geese at the back are inflatable decoys. It's a very hunting-oriented community. At the talk that I did at the university there, so it was just by word of mouth that people were invited to come and work with me in this space, I invited people to come in, and they did. Students and faculty from the University of Regina, clown and performance artists from the community, children and grandchildren and spouses of the people came in. And I asked them to work with the material that I had brought in, that I had imported, as well as local materials that I brought, also anything that they brought. And I asked everyone to leave an open-ended possibility. So if someone came in and started building a mesh structure up on the ceiling, I'd ask them to leave one thing that was undone, something unfinished that the next person coming in could respond to. So maybe a string left untied, and the next person would see that as an invitation to continue building. I was there for 13 days. So the University of Regina students from the Education Department spent about a day bringing in this gold foil and wrapping it around the table. And when everyone left at the end of the day, I had my chance to respond to that, whatever they had made. And my response to this was to upturn it. I'm interested in the idea of ungrounding architecture, something that John Roshman writes about in his book Constructions. And this idea of upturning preconceived ways of working with material, but also working with survival strategies, is something that continues to fuel my practice. The top three objects up there are the insides of dryers, the internal workings of a clothes dryer from the architectural salvage place. And this is the first time that people actually came into the space after listening to my talk and wanted to trade for things, because they started to know the history of the ceramic objects that I brought in. They knew that they'd been here and they'd been glazed here and they'd been fired here. My things are glazed maybe 7 to 12 times until the material starts to melt and to lean and to transform in ways that over time are very unpredictable, very brittle. How the glaze will flow, how tall a coil will stand when it's upright, and in the heat, how much it will bend. I like to leave those kinds of things unpredictable. So when they started hearing that history, they would bring in something and say, well, can I take this piece away with me? And so for the first time, I'm interested in this idea of barter and gift giving as maybe part of the process that will fuel future work. With a lot of the upturning and materials breaking and falling, I wanted to leave a lot of that evidence of what happened in a more performative space when people came to view the work. So boardwalks were placed over less safe areas so people could gingerly walk their way across. So when things broke, I let them break and let them fall and let them be there. And the wetness of the clay left a scent in the room. There's that smell of clay coming out of bags that is usually relegated to the studio space for me. So it was very satisfying to come in there. And this corner room that they gave me to keep the mess away from other works that were maybe more fragile, that smell was very present in that room. That humidity permeated the room. This wall was one of the walls that was brought up from an old installation that was down in the basement of the gallery in Deep Six. And just the way that people started looking at the way I had been pinching and the way I had been moving my hands and how they riffed from that, how they responded to that and became improvisational in the way that they were moving material has always been really interesting to me. That's an oar at the bottom, a big, oversized sea oar that was part of the props as well. And this fencing that happened through the space was from a golf course that they put through the gallery. So for the gallery staff coming in and security guards, they knew all of these things. These objects had histories for them in ways that the ceramics that I bring with me each time I install have resonance for me. About 2 years ago, I committed to keeping all of the ceramic objects that I built in my practice. So wherever I go to install a show, the ceramics will come with me. This could mean that things are too big and can be transformed by smashing them down into the little tiny bits, or putting them back into glaze form, or refiring them in different configurations so they contain more volume and have more mass. But I'm interested in what happens when I have to confront the product of my labor and bring that with me each time I bring it to a new space. A lot of the poetic moments that happened during the installation were not mine. And so just having people use the things that I was making and being able to interpret that for themselves in the space was exciting for me. This was made by a 6-year-old boy who took a Rory McDonald's wood-fired pot at the bottom. Rory is a professor there at the University of Regina, and found a press-molded face that was donated by one of my students at the end of semester. Students are always throwing away things at the end of the semester, and I collect these things, and they're put together by people who were working with me. When children came into the space, they said, well, if we can do anything with the stuff you give us, can we throw the stuff? So I was like, sure. So that wall became kind of a target practice. So there was a lot of noise and a lot of kinetic energy in the space while especially children were there slamming clay against the walls, and things would shake and fired ceramics would fall down from the walls. So the question for me would be, where is the work most live, or do we have to choose where it's most live? In the performative space of bringing the piece together, or in its final state? And I would argue that there is no final state, because every time someone coming in would leave an open-ended joint for someone to work with, that creates a whole new possibility for someone coming in, if not physically, at least conceptually. A lot of the iconography that comes into this is from childhood memories of religious pictures. There is a hammock picture there, and in growing up, 5, 6 years old, I would see this hammock full of strange wild animals, kind of some vision in some revelation story, and that's something that I like to bring in terms of the wildness of broken objects and the unpredictability of things suspended in that space when something is swinging. So that kinetic energy is important there for me. And people brought in their own iconography as well. A lot of the students that worked with me were First Nations students, and so medicine wheels and a lot of First Nations drawings came into play on the walls and in the objects that people were making. Work by old colleagues that have broken and they donated to me. That's a piece by Garrett Grimm that one of the breath and body workers started to string up and suspend within this hollow Roman column. A group of collaborators that came and worked with me were students from St. Luke's School. It's an alternative school for children and teens that aren't working out at other schools. A lot of the kids are on probation and have parole officers, and there were always two staff with us at all times to make sure things were running smoothly. But the kids that came in were really engaged by the process of not only making the things, but recording the process themselves. I had a video camera that I would give to them, so all of the things that they were able to experience were documented by themselves. This is Jasmine with the video camera. Leroy, and it took about 30 seconds before Charlene came on the scene.
That's okay.
the children to do anything or the teens to do anything, they were initiating the acts themselves.
This show represents when I was more in a state of, you know, the altered state, a bit crazy, a bit, and then you come out of that and learn new things. And these tales are going to be my five friends who are supporting me through something right now. And I was going to cut it off, but I had this piece here, and I realized I could just join all the tales together because we're
Absolutely.
All friends.
Totally.
Like,
oh, yeah.
Just so neat how this work happens, eh? And so cool. I'm learning so many things.
Me too.
We're done.
Totally.
We're done, people.
So what would you like, what are you, by telling us you're done, what would you like us to do?
Those were more collaborators in the space. That was Lynn and her grandson was done. Is it comfort with no risk that is embodied by this insistent pinching? Impersonating the mindless, repetitive gesture of a Victorian lady's embroidering hand, the faith and duty to produce, to remake, to help, to meddle, to fix. As the work becomes form without edges, or named territory, I see three green turtles, a musing blue and white boy, a shipment of ghost cattle, and they are in place with no sustained direction, no reliable sense of gravity. Nothing is thrown away. Old yogurt is used to jumpstart the new batch. What is worth risking for things to get juicy, rare, ripe? What might be discovered on the verge of things going bad?